Happy Dancing Turtle near Pine River invites 4- and 5-year-olds to participate in the Tiny Turtles program this fall. Classes begin Monday, September 8th, and continue twice a month through November. Classes are held entirely outdoors. Find more info at happydancingturtle.org. Now back to Weekend Edition.
It's Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Summer break is over for Congress. They're coming back with a lot of work to do, including funding the government. We have a preview. And the government's update of dietary guidelines is due out in just a few months. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is promising big changes. Plus, forget about falling in love. These classics focus on love's demise. Divorce movies.
If we start from a place of reasonable and they start from a place of crazy, when we settle, we'll be somewhere between reasonable and crazy.
It's Sunday, August 31st. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The nation's eyes remain on Minneapolis following Wednesday's deadly school shooting. Amid the calls for action, some stress that people should learn authentic ways to talk with and support survivors even when the spotlight fades. Democratic leaders and parents gathered in Minneapolis on Thursday to renew calls to ban assault rifles. They echoed frustration over more innocent children losing their lives. Journalist Justin Agrello says it's important to make arguments using facts and data that these attacks shouldn't be a normal thing. But in a past project interviewing gun violence survivors in Chicago, he says he also learned more about the human aspect following a tragedy.
When someone experiences gun violence, it is the ultimate stripping of their agency. Whether they were a direct survivor or whether they lost a loved one, or in the case in Minneapolis, if they lost a child, right, or a sibling, they did not choose that.
Agrello says survivors can get some of that agency back when peers and loved ones, or policymakers and support groups, respect their wishes about how to discuss their experience. He says it doesn't mean walking on eggshells around them, but rather asking if it's okay to bring up a specific aspect of their grieving. He also says people shouldn't make assumptions about what a survivor needs and that checking first is best. Teacher Abby Clements is a survivor of the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting and co-founder of Teachers Unify to End Gun Violence. She strongly believes access to guns is a factor that can't be ignored. She also agrees there needs to be a healthy balance in how the public processes these tragedies.
We know that statistics alone have not moved the needle. So we need to do better about creating space for stories.
Clements says her group aims to do that for educators, including the opportunity to speak anonymously. Meanwhile, Agrello hopes survivors aren't only called upon to share stories when there's a congressional hearing or a milestone anniversary. And he encourages the media and others to emphasize the accomplishments, interests, and aspirations of those who died from gun violence.
I think it's important to name not just how people died, but also how they lived.
Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for the story. A lab test has confirmed the death of a 3-year-old horse in Kitson County earlier this month was due to West Nile virus. The Minnesota Board of Animal Health reported the equine case was the first confirmed in the state this year, with 6 more confirmations of the mosquito-borne disease shortly thereafter. The other horses testing positive were in Fillmore, Lincoln, Wadena, Mille Lacs, and Wabasha counties. 5 of the 7 have died. In all cases, the animals were either unvaccinated or had an unknown vaccination history. Infected horses cannot spread the virus to people or other horses. The Minnesota Department of Health also recently announced it confirmed 20 cases of West Nile virus in humans so far this year, and 2 people have died. The Minnesota PCA will host a public informational meeting Wednesday in Virginia on the draft wastewater permits and variance request from U.S. Steel for its Keetac mine. The meeting will provide information about the agency's preliminary determination to deny the sulfate variance permit, as well as information about the Keetac mine and tailings basin permits and how to submit public comments. U.S. Steel estimated it would need to spend $814 million to comply with the state's sulfate standards. Minnesota has had the standards since 1973, designed to protect the state's wild rice resources, but it hasn't been strongly enforced. Meeting attendees who would like to provide an oral comment are expected to sign up at the door of the Iron Trail Motors Event Center between 5:30 and 6:15. U.S. Steel will host an open house before the meeting from 4 to 6, also at the Iron Trail Motors Event Center. A large audience is expected, and comments will be limited to 2 minutes. Attendees can also submit written comments at the meeting or online until September 22nd. Drivers around Wadena can expect a major change in construction traffic this weekend. Highway 10 will reopen with one lane each way. Drivers can expect lane shifts and no shoulders. Highway 71 in Wadena will close with a detour posted on County Road 20. Access to County Road 92 off Highway 10 will remain closed for construction of a roundabout. Beginning Tuesday through mid-October, Highway 71 is expected to be closed with a temporary all-way stop in place at County Road 20 and Juniper Avenue. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
It's Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Lawmakers are coming back to D.C. this week after their August recess. Starting Tuesday, they'll be back on Capitol Hill and facing a long to-do list, with the risk of a government shutdown looming in the background. Now stop us if you've heard that one before. Joining us now to help preview what's on the agenda is NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales. Hi, Claudia.
Good morning, Aisha.
So I hope you enjoyed the recess. It sounds like there will be lots to take care of when lawmakers return. Where should we start?
Probably what you just mentioned, funding the government. That's likely the hardest job on tap. The deadline to do that is September 30th. So when lawmakers get back, they'll have less than a month to approve regular appropriations bills. That's a process that can take months. And they're already very much behind. Many say it's a fantasy they'll get there. For example, many House Republicans just want to approve another stopgap measure that will keep funding levels static. Then, underlying all of this, we have seen this Republican-led Congress cede their power of the purse to the president again and again. For example, this summer, they passed a rescissions package from the White House that clawed back $9 billion in foreign aid and funding for public media. So we're expecting President Trump to have a lot to say here, and Democrats say they're going to fight these efforts in a new way.
So then the nearly evergreen question, could we be headed toward a shutdown at the end of the month?
It's possible. We have heard discussion that some lawmakers would approve a shorter term stopgap measure, say for a month, for example, to give them time to negotiate. Democrats, for example, they have faced demands from their base to do more when it comes to these funding battles. For example, earlier this year, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer made way for a GOP stopgap spending plan to move forward, but he paid the price with a lot of blowback from the base. So Democrats are expecting to do a lot more fighting this time around. So that means Republicans could face a roadblock when it comes to passing a funding measure if Senate Democrats filibuster that effort.
The Jeffrey Epstein issue is also waiting for lawmakers to take it back up after garnering so much attention this summer. Where do things stand there?
Right. They're coming back, Republicans, to quite the crossroads here because they have heard demands from their own base about presenting more transparency on this case and that they haven't delivered on campaign promises to release files related to this. Now, we did see the House Oversight Committee have a busy August. They issued subpoenas for documents and witness testimony. The Justice Department started turning over files from its investigation into Epstein to the committee, and the Republican chairman, James Comer of Kentucky, says he intends to make the records public. But Democrats are going to have a lot to say. They're arguing that Comer is slow walking the process. They say the release will be far from comprehensive once the public gets to see it. And they have a key ally in Kentucky Republican Thomas Massie. He's teamed up with Democrats to try to force a vote on a full release of the records on the House floor come next week.
Okay, quickly, what else are you watching for from Congress?
Well, we know the Senate left in the midst of fighting over approving President Trump's nominees that will likely pick up, and lawmakers will need to face some music on a lot of issues that boiled over during recess. Republicans saw blowback on the major bill that they passed earlier this summer from Trump's demands, and Trump has also exerted more influence on the Federal Reserve, and we've seen a lot of chaos at the CDC and expect a lot from Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. when he testifies later this week.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales. Thanks, Claudia.
Thank you.
Democrats and Republicans can't agree on much lately, but there is a kind of alignment on one issue, addressing homelessness. Clearing encampments has become a priority for leaders in both parties. In Oakland, California, one group of homeless people resisted city cleanup crews and advocated for a piece of land of their own where they could set the rules.
Once you're homeless, or once you run out of money in this country, are the choices you're left with even real choices at all?
A new podcast series from member station KQED chronicles that effort, and there's a preview later today on All Things Considered. Tune in on the radio or tell your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. It's been 70 years since the lynching of Emmett Till, a black teenager from Chicago who was visiting family in Mississippi. White men kidnapped, tortured, shot, and dumped him in a river. Today, the state of Mississippi is embracing the Emmett Till story at its Civil Rights Museum and spotlighting a new artifact, the murder weapon. The exhibit is in contrast to the Trump administration's push to downplay the darkest parts of America's racial history. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Wheeler Parker Jr. is Emmett Till's cousin. They grew up next door to each other in Chicago. In the summer of 1955, when he was 16 and Till was 14, they traveled together to Mississippi to visit relatives. Now 86, his memories of that trip are still vivid. He recalls their visit to Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market in Money, Mississippi. As they were leaving, shopkeeper Carolyn Bryant came outside. Parker says Till tried to be a jokester, not understanding how dangerous that could be in the Jim Crow South.
And Emmett, being like he was, love to make you laugh, he gave her the wolf whistle. We could have died.
Parker is the last living eyewitness to what happened 70 years ago. A few days later, he says Carolyn Bryant's husband, Roy, and his half-brother, J.W. Milam, showed up in the wee hours of the morning at Parker's grandfather's house, where they were staying. Wheeler says they came into his room first with a pistol and flashlight before finding Till.
He took him this last time and saw him alive.
Till's bloated and beaten body was later found floating in the Tallahatchie River, weighted down by a cotton gin fan. The state of Mississippi has a new artifact to illuminate the story of the lynching.
This is a pistol that we believe is the weapon that was used to kill Emmett Till.
Nan Prince, director of collections for the Mississippi Department of Archives and History, is in a basement conservation lab with the gun laid out on a rolling cart.
It belonged to J.W. Milam, along with the holster.
Milam's initials are carved into the leather case.
I've been in this field for a long time, and I've never had an artifact affect me quite like this when I first saw it. It's just a tough thing to see, especially when you know how it was used and just the hatred that must have led to its use that night.
Back in 1955, an all-white jury acquitted Milam and Bryant of the crime, but the men later confessed to a reporter. Prince says the FBI has confirmed that the serial number on the gun matches their investigation records. She says it's a significant discovery, one that will now be part of the Emmett Till exhibit at the State Civil Rights Museum in Jackson. Museum director Michael Morris says it adds to what's known about Till's murder.
To me, this weapon just allows us to tell a fuller story about what happened to him.
Till's mother, Mamie Till Mobley, had insisted on an open casket funeral so the world could see what they did to her son. The outcry helped fuel the civil rights movement.
A lot of the folks that I've met through the years that got involved in the movement, they all point back to the impact of the murder of Emmett Till. That's what galvanized them to be a part of the movement.
Mississippi is showcasing exhibits like this one at a time when President Trump is attacking the Smithsonian Institution and other museums for being too woke in the way they portray difficult American history. Archives director Katie Blunt says she has not experienced that same backlash in conservative Mississippi, where state lawmakers allocated funding for a civil rights and history museum. She says telling Mississippi's history is something the agency has been doing since it set up its first permanent civil rights exhibit in the 1980s.
So in a sense, we are today just doing what the department has always done, which is telling in a very even, balanced, and accurate way the stories that make up our state.
Blunt says the agency has long worked to preserve artifacts and sites associated with Emmett Till's murder, but had never located the gun. Then it surfaced in a history of the case published last year called The Barn by Wright Thompson. Thompson says the gun had been stored in a safety deposit box for decades. The family holding it asked to remain anonymous. Thompson is relieved that the state now has it.
I think it's really important that this thing be sort of safe in the context of a museum and not just floating out in the world.
Thompson says Mississippi telling the truth shows strength.
And not being so scared of your past that you can't forge some brighter future. I mean, I just think it's the most basic act of citizenship is to say, this is what happened. This is who we are.
For Emmett Till's cousin, Wheeler Parker, the discovery of the gun is more personal.
It's been something that I've always wondered about for 70 years.
He says it gives validity to the horror of the history.
Some of the people of this time, they don't want these stories told. It's American history, and they want to wipe it out. They want to pretend like it never happened. But we need to tell the story.
With the gun, the story has a new chapter, one that Parker says gives him a sense of closure. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Jackson, Mississippi.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Begley Area Arts Collaborative, offering workshops in September, preparing for Fall Colors, a two-session photography workshop, September 13th and 20th at Itasca State Park, and Oils Made Easy, September 24th through the 26th in Park Rapids. More information and registration at begleyarts.org or on Facebook. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit, Reclaimed, Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5, and Sundays 11 to 4. The Bemidji Senior Center hosts a Medicare presentation Wednesday, September 3rd at 1 p.m., learn about the plans available before open enrollment, which begins October 15th.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson is pushing back against President Trump. He signed an executive order this weekend that prevents city police from cooperating with any federal immigration enforcement activity. And Johnson is demanding President Trump stand down from any plan to deploy National Guard troops to Chicago. President Trump says he will issue an executive order mandating voter ID for every vote. In a social media post, Trump also said he wants to restrict mail-in voting and allow only paper ballots. The Constitution, however, gives authority over elections to the states. And the jackpot for tomorrow night's Powerball lottery has grown to an estimated $1.1 billion. No one has matched all six numbers since the end of May. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice. At ajws.org. This is NPR.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Israel's military is gearing up to intensify the war in Gaza and to take over Gaza City, estimated to house around 1 million Palestinians. Israel wants all of them to evacuate to southern Gaza. For an update on this and other developments in the region, we're joined now by NPR's Daniel Estrin. He's in Tel Aviv. Hi, Daniel.
Good morning, Aisha.
So first, the takeover plans. Where do things stand today?
Israeli ground troops are positioned in two neighborhoods on the outskirts of Gaza City. They have been engaged in heavy bombardment there. This is being presented by the military as the preliminary stages of the Gaza City assault. Israel has also stopped doing these daily 10-hour pauses in fighting. They have been doing that to allow trucks of food and aid into the Gaza City area, and Israel agreed to do that under international pressure to address starvation in Gaza. But they're not doing that anymore in the Gaza City area. Israel has declared the city a, quote, dangerous combat zone. Israel is also planning to phase out humanitarian aid to North Gaza, including Gaza City. And the point of all this, Aisha, is to force Palestinians to leave if they wish to find food and safety.
So what does this look like on the ground? Are many Palestinians fleeing Gaza City?
Some have fled Gaza City, especially the bombardment on the outskirts of the city, but there has not been a mass exodus of people from the city yet, even though Israel has issued many warnings telling them that leaving Gaza City is inevitable for them. And so this really is the central question now. Will the million or so Palestinians in Gaza City actually leave? Hamas is calling on people to remain defiant and not to leave. And many Palestinians may end up deciding there's no space for them further south in Gaza, where there's already there are many tent camps that are overcrowded. And so all this can complicate Israel's plans with Gaza City, because if Palestinians do stay when the army, if and when the army enters this dense urban area, it would be deadly. Now, Israel presents all of this as a way to protect civilians from fighting, asking them to leave. But you do also hear Israeli leaders voicing other goals, like taking over as much territory in Gaza as possible and finding countries that will take in Palestinians in order to reduce Gaza's population. The International Committee of the Red Cross says that a mass evacuation of Gaza City would be impossible to do safely.
There have also been some recent strikes by Israel against senior officials in the region. What more do we know?
Yeah, Israel says the military targeted and killed the main spokesman of Hamas in Gaza this weekend. Hamas has not yet commented on that. Also, a few days ago, an Israeli airstrike killed the Houthi prime minister of the rebel-controlled government in Yemen's capital. The Houthis are backed by Iran, and they have been launching missiles at Israel throughout the Gaza war. The Houthi prime minister and other government ministers were killed during a cabinet meeting that they were having. And a person familiar with the matter in Israel who was not allowed to speak publicly told me that this evening the Israeli cabinet will be expected to meet in a secret location in case of retaliatory strikes.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome.
Americans will soon get some new advice on what to eat. The federal government updates its dietary guidelines every 5 years. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said the Trump administration plans to release the 2025 version by the end of September. NPR health correspondent Will Stone is here to tell us more about why these guidelines are getting extra attention. Hi, Will.
Hey there.
Secretary Kennedy has made food and diet a central issue in his Make America Healthy Again agenda. What's he said about the guidelines?
Quite a lot, actually. Kennedy and others in the administration have, in certain ways, vilified the current guidelines, blaming them for high rates of obesity and diet-related diseases in the U.S. Obviously, food, poor nutrition is a huge driver of these problems. At the same time, some of Kennedy's statements have mischaracterized the process and what these guidelines are. And to give you a sense, take a listen to what he said during a congressional hearing in the spring.
We took the Biden guidelines, which were 453 pages long and were clearly written by industry, that are incomprehensible, driven by the same industry capture and those kind of carnal impulses that put Fruit Loops at the top of the food pyramid. And we are changing that.
Kennedy has gone on to say the forthcoming guidelines will be brief, they'll be easy to read, and they will emphasize, quote, whole foods, healthy foods, and local foods.
So how much of what Kennedy said there is actually accurate about the current guidelines?
Yeah, there's a lot in there. First of all, the food pyramid was actually retired more than 10 years ago. It did not mention specific products like Fruit Loops. That was replaced by a visual called My Plate. That describes the food groups and how much you should aim for. For example, it says, try to fill half of your plate with fruits and vegetables. More broadly, it's important to realize the guidelines are developed by a committee of leading experts in nutrition through an extensive review of the data. The current ones from 2020 were released under the Trump administration. During the Biden years, a scientific committee was assembled to put together its report for this 2025 version. They don't actually write the guidelines, though. They offer recommendations. And what gets released is ultimately up to the Department of Agriculture and HHS.
So does it seem like there will be some big changes this time around?
Well, that's definitely what Kennedy and others seem to be indicating. The definition of a healthy eating pattern has remained pretty consistent over the years, emphasizing vegetables and fruits, whole grains, lean meat, and limiting certain foods like saturated fat, added sugar. That's echoed in the newest report. But Kennedy has made no secret of his love for beef tallow and meat more broadly. So that could be one change we see. He's also called for elevating the role of whole fat dairy. Ultra-processed food is another area to watch. I spoke to Deanna Helsher, who's at the UT Health Houston School of Public Health. She was on the 2025 committee and says some people have misunderstood their findings.
We did say there was a relationship between consumption of ultra-processed foods and health outcomes, and specifically to growth, body composition, and obesity, but the relationship was limited.
And she says that's partly because scientists are still figuring out exactly how to define ultra-processed food, and high-quality evidence is pretty limited right now, so they have to be cautious. And I think, Aisha, this just underscores the committee tends to be pretty conservative in their recommendations. They don't want to get ahead of the science. Now, Kennedy and others in the MAHA movement have talked a lot about the harms of ultra-processed food, and they could push this much further.
So how consequential would it be if the new guidelines stray from these recommendations?
Well, it is worth pointing out that most Americans currently don't follow the dietary guidelines. But Barbara Schneeman tells me they still matter a lot. She was the chair of the 2020 scientific committee.
They are used in federal government policy. They're used by educators. They're used by health professionals. So undercutting the guidelines, I think it will have major implications for many programs. My hope is there will be awareness of what the advisory committee did so that people can judge for themselves if it gets changed.
Schneeman says in 2020, the Trump administration did not heed all of their advice, for example, on added sugar and alcohol. But for the most part, they did follow the recommendations. Whether that happens this time, we may find out in a few weeks.
That's NPR's health correspondent, Will Stone. Thank you so much, Will.
Thank you.
James Dobson touched millions with his advice on parenting, sexuality, and relationships. To many, the recently deceased founder of the global Christian ministry Focus on the Family was a man of enormous compassion. But in Colorado Springs, where Focus is based, many remember him as a divisive figure who campaigned against civil rights for queer people. Colorado Public Radio's Noel Black reports.
K. Cole James, president of the Heritage Foundation, held back tears during a memorial broadcast of the radio show James Dobson founded. She recalled a phone call with Dobson after her son had just come out as gay.
Jim and Shirley stayed on the phone for an hour and a half with us, crying with us, counseling with us, encouraging us to love our son. And I wish that people could know that side of Jim Dobson, Jim Dobson, the friend.
But many people in Colorado Springs, where Dobson built his empire, never felt that love and won't remember him as a friend.
It's okay with me that he's gone. I guess that's what I'm going to say.
Pamela Draper has lived in the Colorado Springs area since 1977, the year James Dobson founded Focus on the Family in California. She remembers clearly when Dobson and Focus moved to town in 1991. She had come out as a lesbian a few years earlier, which hadn't seemed like a big deal at the time.
I felt that we all got along.
Even as a Black lesbian woman, she felt like Colorado Springs, though always conservative, had been very live and let live. But after Focus arrived, a dark political cloud seemed to move in over the city.
Then it became clear that there was going to be a focus on gay people.
Dobson believed gay people could be cured with the proper faith and counseling. And in 1992, he campaigned for Amendment 2, a state ballot initiative to limit gay rights.
Amendment 2, they sold it to ensure that the gay population does not get what they call special rights.
John Harner, a University of Colorado professor, wrote a book called Profiting from the Peak on the history of Colorado Springs. He says there were already a lot of Christian nonprofits in the city when Dobson arrived, and they generally stayed out of local politics. But the ballot initiative changed all that, and Dobson's power drew even more religious nonprofits and evangelical churches to Colorado Springs.
So this became a real conservative Christian mecca for a long time.
Okay, you're on.
Dobson's campaign for the ballot initiative seemed to change the city's tolerance, says Richard Scorman, who runs Poor Richard's Restaurant and Bookstore, a downtown haven for Colorado Springs left-leaning communities since the 1970s.
We got bricks thrown through our window. We had bomb threats. One brick had a note on it saying it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
His restaurant became a place for the gay community and supporters to organize.
So if you happen to be LGBTQ, you could get fired. You could be kicked out of an apartment. You could be denied, you know, service in a restaurant. And it came from Colorado Springs.
The amendment passed, but was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court 4 years later as unconstitutional. The upside, for many of those who lived through that time, was that it galvanized the gay and lesbian community and those who supported them. Former mayor Mary Lou Makepeace, a Christian and a Republican, says she didn't know anyone gay before Dobson came to town. But as a woman and a leader, she believed in equal rights for all.
So when Dobson is portrayed as this holier-than-thou guy, I wonder, is he aware of the Ten Commandments and all the other biblical kinds of things?
After she served as mayor, Makepeace became director of the Gill Foundation, a gay rights advocacy organization which created the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado to highlight the contributions of the LGBTQ community.
I have to thank Dobson for being so extreme, because he made the people that he was denigrating stronger. They had to stand up for themselves, and that was refreshing. It took a while, but it was refreshing.
In 2009, James Dobson stepped down as chair of Focus on the Family, and Colorado Springs had begun to shake its reputation as the evangelical Vatican. Recently, Colorado Springs, with its majestic views of Pikes Peak, has been named the number two best place to live by U.S. News and World Report. Young people flocked here during COVID. Pamela Draper, who saw the city change under James Dobson's influence, says she's glad she, her wife, and daughter stayed, fought, and outlasted Dobson's attempts to limit civil rights.
I love Colorado Springs, and I tend to focus more on the beauty. And I have friends of every persuasion, including Republicans, evangelicals.
Out at Focus on the Family's sprawling 50-acre campus in northern Colorado Springs, on the day after James Dobson's death, there were no flowers or signs, no cards, candles, or ad hoc memorials. But the empire he built and the massive complex of brick buildings that sits like a suburban version of the proverbial castle on a hill looking out over Colorado Springs will no doubt remain for years to come. For NPR News, I'm Noel Black in Colorado Springs.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Do you ever go to bed feeling just fine, but wake up with a stiff neck or achy shoulders? In a 2016 study looking at more than 150 conditions, researchers found Americans spent more healthcare dollars on neck and lower back pain than anything else, some $130 billion. But according to LifeKit reporter Andy Tagle, much of that pain may be preventable by just paying closer attention to how you sleep and what you sleep with. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Aisha.
What do you mean by, like, how you sleep?
What it comes down to is spinal alignment. I talked to Ellen Wormter about this. She's a nurse practitioner and behavioral sleep medicine specialist out of Virginia. She told me, just like when you stand or sit at a desk, to prevent pain, you need good posture when you sleep.
You want your neck to be aligned with the upper back, your chin and neck aligned to the center of your shoulders in line with your hips, and then you want your head looking forward, not bent up and not bent down.
In case you couldn't quite picture that, all she's saying is you want to aim to sleep the way you stand, as in a straight line from the top of your head to your tailbone. You wouldn't go walking around all day with your head completely turned to one side, right? But plenty of people sleep that way. And spending hours in awkward angles at night is how you end up with daytime soreness and stiffness.
Okay, got it. Is there an optimal position to sleep in?
Well, yes and no. Wormter says every posture has pros and cons, but there is a clear worst position, according to a lot of sleep experts.
Really, avoiding stomach sleeping is the biggest posture recommendation. The main issue is it's really hard to keep your head looking forward because it naturally bends up, or you turn it to the side. And when you turn it to the side, you're getting some tension there with the rotating.
So stomach sleeping is the least common among adults. It can open your airways, but it's most associated with morning pain like neck and shoulder aches, as well as more fragmented sleep. So if you're set on this posture like I am, Wormter suggests a very thin pillow or no pillow at all to limit the strain on your body.
Oh my goodness, I sleep on my stomach, so that's why I've been having all these neck and upper back pains. Oh my goodness, that's what I need to know. But what about the people who sleep on their back and side?
Back sleeping is considered the best for spinal alignment, which makes sense, right? It looks the most like standing. But Wormter says to be careful that your head pillow doesn't elevate the neck too much, so you want to opt for something thinner or something ergonomic, like with a cutout for the curve of your neck. You also want to be sure to support any gaps at the small of your back or under your knees. Finally, for side sleepers, this is the most common sleeping position and also the healthiest, according to some measures. For example, lying on your left side increases circulation. So if this is your preference, the loft or height of your pillow is going to be especially important. Wormter says to find the ideal head pillow, you want to measure from the bend of your neck to the edge of your shoulder. So if you're very broad, you're going to need a larger pillow.
What do we need to know about pillows and like mattresses so that we can avoid waking up in pain?
So the big takeaway from Wormter is it's probably time to replace what you have at home. You know, ideal type is just user's choice, trial and error based on your sleep style. But the Better Sleep Council suggests replacing all pillows every 2 to 3 years to account for cleanliness and because pillows lose their structure over time. And for those same reasons, they suggest replacing your mattress every 7 to 8 years because an unsupportive pillow or mattress can literally be a pain in the neck.
That's LifeKit reporter Andy Tagle. Thank you so much. I learned a lot. Get some rest tonight.
So glad to hear it. You too, Aisha.
Thank you. This is NPR News.
You're tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Grand Rapids Riverfest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at grandrapidsriverfest.com. Want to volunteer at the event? Head to grandrapidsriverfest.com under Get Involved. Local author Anne Marie Erickson celebrates the launch of her new book, In the Evening We'll Dance, a memoir and essays on love and dementia, Thursday, September 4th at 7 p.m. at the McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids. Erickson will read brief excerpts of the book and sign copies. Woodcut print artist Dan McLaughlin has work on display at the Brainerd Public Library through the end of September. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Democratic Senators Chris Van Hollen of Maryland and Jeff Merkley of Oregon are calling on Israel to allow more food aid into Gaza. The two visited the Egyptian side of the Rafah border crossing this weekend as Israel steps up military operations around Gaza City and announced the recovery of the bodies of two hostages. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi says India is committed to improving ties with China. Modi met today with Chinese President Xi Jinping on the sidelines of a regional security summit overshadowed by President Trump's tariffs. And during a public prayer at the Vatican for the victims of Wednesday's shooting at a Catholic school mass in Minneapolis, Pope Leo today demanded an end to what he called a pandemic of arms. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. For Pokemon fans, this summer, the most exciting place on Earth was the Convention Center in Anaheim, California. That's where thousands of players and fans recently gathered for the annual Pokemon World Championships. But as Jamal Michelle reports, for some, Pokemon is about more than just winning.
Growing up in South Florida in the 90s, no kid was immune from Pokemania.
At Greenwood Elementary School, lunchtime is trading time, and the cards are flying.
I even traded away my lunch money for a folder full of some pretty dope original Pokemon cards, and my mom was furious. It didn't help that every weekend I drove her up the wall to take me to my local Toys R Us. Back then, the retailer hosted some of the first official events through the Pokemon League. It was just a space for neighborhood kids to battle each other and trade.
You'll do awesome activities, learn wicked strategies, earn cool trainer badges, and meet new friends as you begin your journey to become a Pokemon Master Trainer.
25 years later, what everyone thought was just a fad that wouldn't survive the moment turned into a media behemoth. Last year, the Pokemon Company pulled in $12 billion. And it hasn't let off the gas. Just this month, it hosted its 20th World Championships in Anaheim, California, to the tune of over 25,000 fans in attendance. Folks came from across the globe. And for me, it was decades overdue since my Toys R Us days.
We have an interesting fight possibly breaking up over that area. Our crew right here is canned in a lot of trouble. They are going to go down.
Yet for some, they were surprised to even be there.
Coming to the Pokemon World Championships was not on my 2025 bingo card, but here we are.
That's Annalise DeMille, a mother from Australia whose son just made the cut to qualify for the event.
My son is 9, and this is his first year playing Pokemon competitively. Oceania only has 10 qualifying spots for the World Championships, and we have found ourselves flying, 15 hours because of tiny pieces of cardboard. Life is incredible.
We talked about the sea of young competitors trying to get to the top, and the potential hardship and heartache of defeat that comes with trying to be the very best. DeMille says Pokemon is the best game to help with losing.
My son is neurodivergent, and part of his personality is that he'd be very, very perfectionist. And through Pokemon and playing so many games all the time, the repetition, the creativity behind it, he knows that a loss doesn't define who he is, and it doesn't even define what happens next.
Win or lose, it's all about perspective for many of these players, even veterans who've been to this rodeo before. Kieran Farrell was Canada's number one ranked trading card game player in 2023.
It turned out pretty well. I finished in the top 32. I think I was like 21st or 22nd. I unfortunately tied my last round. If I would have won, I would have made it to the top 8 knockout round.
This was his 9th championship event. And despite the massive surge of competitors, he's happy with how it turned out. And also just happy to play.
World is always like the premier weekend of the year for me. You know, you get to see all your friends from around the world. Which is really cool. One of the great things about Pokemon tournaments is it's truly a global game, and Worlds kind of brings everyone together for that.
For fans like me, the Pokemon Company has always been a place to find friendship. And it didn't stop with us. DeMille sees it happening with her son, too.
Finding, you know, your tribe who have that common interest and things that they can just talk away at a million miles an hour is really precious. And they're all just supporting each other and cheering each other on while they have the time of their life.
For NPR News, I'm Jamal Michelle.
A new crime novel has a surprisingly tender side despite its menacing title. What About the Bodies is set in a town where the glory days have packed up and gone, Locksburg, Pennsylvania. The steel plants closed, the mines too. And the folks who remain, quote, always seem to talk about leaving. Three characters converge there. They have little in common, except they all could use a change of luck. And that's where we begin with author Ken Jaworowski. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Aisha.
Give us a quick sketch of the three protagonists in this book. There's Carla, Liz, and Reed. And obviously, without giving anything away, they are each facing some challenges, to put it mildly.
Yes, they are. They're facing challenges, and the town they're in, as you described, is facing a lot of challenges too. Carla is a single mother. She's been a waitress her whole life. She's trying to get some money together to start her own restaurant. Reed is an autistic young man who has been picked on a little bit throughout his life, and now he's made a promise that he has to keep. And Liz is a down-and-out musician, and she's right on the cusp of her dream. She's just about to have that dream come true, and all of a sudden some problems arise.
There's a passage in the book that I wanted you to read. It's where the character Reed is in the town graveyard, and he has this observation that becomes the title of the novel. Could you read that for us?
I sure can. Here we go. This is Reed. The cemetery is huge for such a small town because Locksburg was not always such a small town. At one time, it was thriving. For years and years, there were a lot of people in Locksburg, but most of them left when the coal mines closed. You might ask what happened to all the living people and where did they go, but you never ask what about the bodies. That is because most times bodies stay where they are buried. The living do not take the dead with them.
As different as the characters are, it does seem like all of them are kind of answering the same question, like how far would you go to follow your dream, or maybe for Carla, protect your son, and Reed for a promise that he made, right?
Absolutely. Look, I hope I wrote a fast-paced thriller. I hope I wrote something entertaining and exciting. But I hope you can also do that and throw in a couple of questions about life and about what we think and about who we are. And you're right. The big question is, how far would you go for what you love? I always say I would do anything for my children, and I truly believe that. And you've heard people say that. I would do anything for my family, do anything for my children, I'd do anything for my parent. But what happens if I asked you, well, what happens if you might be facing 30 years to life in Greater Fruit Prison? That might change your answer a little bit.
Mm. And what do you think about this fictional town, Locksburg, Pennsylvania? Because not to be, you know, trite, but it is a big character in this story. At least for Carla and Liz, that it's this place that they can't escape. But Reed sees another side of it because he has a real love for the town.
Mm-hmm. Some of these towns in Pennsylvania can go either way. Some of them are repurposing themselves from this hard industry past into nice tourist destinations. Some of them are not so lucky. If you live in a major metropolitan area and you lose your job, there's a good chance you could find one somewhat soon. If you live in a small town and the major employer has turned down, you've got bigger problems. And money means something different depending on where you live. So the town itself, I believe, is a character, and it is a place that limits their opportunities. And though that's difficult for a character, when you limit the character's opportunities, boy, it's catnip for a writer. You all of a sudden, when you people get desperate, then the excitement happens.
These are three different characters, and there's a question of like, well, how are these stories going to intersect towards the end of the book? Because they're going and seem to be going in very different directions. How did you plot that out? Like, did you kind of start at the end of the book and work your way back? Or how did you get that? Did you have that in mind, how they were all going to end up getting together?
I have a desk full of old unpublished novels that are collecting dust, and they should collect dust because they're so terrible. And I think the reason I didn't have success with them is because I didn't plot anything else out. I would just roll along and see what happened.
What made you go, okay, I'm going to start approaching this differently? Because a lot of people, if they wrote some novels, they didn't work out, they might not keep going.
Oh, I love this question. I wrote all the past novels. I didn't write this novel. I edited it mostly. I'm not being self-deprecating when I say I don't know if I'm a good writer. I think I am. I hope I am. But I'm not sure if I'm a good writer. But I know I'm a good editor because that's what I get paid to do. And that's what I've gotten paid to do for 20 years is edit. So what I said this time is plot out a story and then go as fast as you can. Don't worry about dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Don't worry about if you're spelling things right. You can go back to those later. And the internet is the biggest enemy of any writer. I will think about a fact, and I'm like, oh, I'll go look that up. And the next thing I know, I go down a rabbit hole. So I said, I also worked on a computer with no internet connection. And I said, I'm not going to do that. So I went as fast as possible. Took 3 months to write it, but took 4 months to edit it.
Well, and you said that's what you get paid to do. So, because you're an editor at the New York Times, right?
Yes, I am.
So that's your day job. And so you took those skills and put it to use in this book.
Correct. I have edited a lot of terrific reporters who are not great writers. They're experts at getting the story. They're expert at talking to people and teasing a good answer out. But when they write the copy, sometimes they're moving a little too fast. Sometimes they're just not really as skilled in writing as they are in reporting. And sometimes they will come over to you after you finished editing their story and they say, that's exactly how I wanted to say it. And I thought, if I can do that for a reporter, I think I can do that for myself too. And I hope I did.
That's writer Ken Jaworowski. His new novel is What About the Bodies? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Aisha. I appreciate it.
Movies about romance are a staple, but what happens when that sweetness turns sour? In the new movie, The Roses, the starring duo heads to couples therapy.
I see so much resentment and defensiveness. An inability to apologize, to share your vulnerability.
Oh, in his defense, he is a whiny baby, so that's vulnerability.
Verbal cruelty.
In England, we call that repartee.
They're played by Olivia Colman and Benedict Cumberbatch, and the movie got us to thinking about divorce and how it looks on screen. Let's bring in NPR movie critic Bob Mondello, who has seen a few of these movies in his time. Hey, Bob.
Hello, and let me start by just confessing something. I view these through a particular lens because my parents really ought to have gotten a divorce.
Mm.
My folks were not happy together. They were together for 36 years. They stayed together because of the kids, they kept saying, and they didn't ask the kids.
Yeah.
If we wanted.
Yeah.
And it was a rough time. Mm. And so when I went to movies and I saw things like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I've tried with you, baby. I really tried.
Come off it, Martha.
I really
tried. I felt as if I was looking at my parents fighting.
So let's start with The Roses. So that's a reimagining of a book and a 1989 movie called The War of the Roses with Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner. What did you think of this new version?
Well, the new one is gentler. The first movie was directed by Danny DeVito, and it got really dark. I mean, by the end of it, these people hated each other. It was like, it made you sweat.
And you owe me a reason that makes sense. So let's hear it. Come on. Let's hear it.
Because
When I watch you eat, when I see you asleep, when I look at you lately, I just want to smash your face in.
In this one, it starts out and it feels sort of like a rom-com. They're doing a lot of establishing the couple. So when it gets darker later, it gets sort of dark, but these roses needed more thorns.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't thorny enough.
Right.
What movies about divorce have stood out to you in a good way?
Well, I was sort of fascinated to discover that as soon as movies started talking, they were talking about divorce. Cary Grant got his start with a bunch of comedies like In Name Only and The Awful Truth.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Mr. Leeson. This is my husband.
Oh.
Oh, he's only my husband for how much longer is it now? 60 days?
59.
Ah, that's better. Only 59 days. And don't worry about him. He has a continental mind.
Yes.
Except that the characters end up staying together because society didn't accept divorce back then. Take that to an extreme with Divorce Italian Style, Catholic Country in 1961. The only option was killing your spouse, which is maybe not the approach most of us would want to take. Divorce American Style softened that a lot. It was Dick Van Dyke and Debbie Reynolds. It was a very money-centric approach. The point is avoiding alimony. So the best option is to find your ex a new partner. There's Marriage Story in 2019 about custody, but also about divorce lawyers.
If we start from a place of reasonable and they start from a place of crazy, when we settle, we'll be somewhere between reasonable and crazy.
Which is still crazy.
Half of crazy is crazy.
Do these movies have much in common besides their subject matter?
Well, I think there are two genres. The comedies are usually like romantic breakup movies on steroids. So they work a lot like rom-coms, and one romance breaks up, and that means that there are other partners suddenly available. The dramas are relationship movies, so they poke at the things that make you weep, like endangered children and financial ruin and loneliness, those kinds of things. In both cases, they're pressure cookers because spouses can't just leave. They have to talk or argue.
What's one all-time classic of the genre that someone might watch if they're in the mood for, you know, I mean, seeing a messy relationship that isn't their own?
I think the best of them is Kramer versus Kramer.
I want my son.
You can't have him.
Now don't get defensive. Don't try to bully me.
I'm not getting defensive. Who walked out of the house 15 months ago?
I don't care.
Joe.
I am still his mother.
Yes, from 3,000 miles away, and just because you sent a few postcards.
It is of its time, because there were certain assumptions made about what Meryl Streep's possibilities were in the career world and what Dustin Hoffman had to do in his career and what was the right choice for him as a father and all those kinds of issues. But I think it is so smart about relationships and also about how when you've had a kid together, there is something there after the fact. You can have decided that the marriage doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that there's no relationship left there. It doesn't mean that there's no feeling. Mm-hmm. And the movie, it's just, there's a reason it won all those Academy Awards. Yeah. It's a really smart take. Mm.
That's NPR's Bob Mondello. Thanks, Bob.
It's always a pleasure, and this one was personal.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in 3 new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. From Dignity Memorial, for many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media.